From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An apparent call from the head of the International Monetary Fund for at least a partial reversal of the programs of austerity in the U.S., EU, and developing world, with IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde urging the world's economies to take stronger action to boost growth. In a speech in Frankfurt Tuesday, Lagarde described the global economy as, quote, too weak and too fragile, closed quote, a quite different message from the usual glowing optimism expressed by political leaders and the media in the U.S. and Europe. CCTV's Edwin Marr has more.
Lagarde said the world economy is out of crisis, but national governments must accelerate structural reforms and increase fiscal support to avoid growing economic risks. And for the first time, Lagarde urged specific policy actions. She proposed that the US raise its minimum wage, the EU provide better job training, and emerging economies spend more on social welfare programs.
Lagarde and the IMF will have a chance later this month to put their money where their mouth is, that is, in Greece, which Monday urged its international creditors to conclude a key pending review as soon as possible to allow the release of a new round of bailout funds of about 5 billion euros that are needed to repay loans from the previous bailout. Athens has asked for the review to be completed by mid-April. That request came after WikiLeaks released details last week of a private discussion among top IMF officials about what it would take to get Greece's creditors to agree to debt relief. The IMF has apparently discussed pulling out of the bailout deal unless European creditors agree to reduce Greece's mountain of debt. An IMF exit would raise the risk of a Greek default in July. But the European creditors, especially Germany, have apparently resisted and are pushing the fund instead to soften the austerity terms it is trying to wrench from Greece. Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said he accepted Lagarde's characterization of the WikiLeaks release and hoped that an agreement could be reached.
I asked International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde whether this leaked conversation was the official position of the IMF. In her answer, Ms. Lagarde called these tactics the same thing I did, nonsense. At the same time, I wonder whether all those who sit at the negotiating table agree with this characterization. I hope that in the upcoming days, we will not see what has come to light come true.
Meanwhile, more austerity appears to be on the horizon for Saudi Arabia. Falling global oil prices have badly affected the Saudi economy, and Riyadh has been spending unprecedented amounts on its military, including support for an occupation of Bahrain and operations in Syria and Yemen. The oil production giant is stepping up its austerity program in an attempt to ward off the threat of national bankruptcy, as Press TV's Marzia Hashimi reports.
Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman says Saudi Arabia's economic reform program would raise an extra $100 billion in revenues a year by 2020. Now, this comes on top of the austerity plan unveiled last December, which included measures such as value-added tax, tax on sugary drinks, as well as a reduction in subsidies for water, energy, and electricity. Last year, the kingdom's budget deficit ballooned to 15% of its GDP as oil revenues collapsed by 23%. Now, the International Monetary Fund says the kingdom needs a global oil price of around $106 per barrel to avoid a budget deficit. Crude prices are currently below $40 a barrel.
For more on those stories, we spoke with Dr. Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and visiting professor in the graduate program in international affairs at the New School University in New York. We spoke with him via Skype from New York Tuesday. The economies of the world are still not recovering from the 2007-2008 in the main. Certainly the United States and Europe haven't abandoned austerity as a strategy for dealing with, I guess, the teetering financial institutions. We're looking at Lagarde yesterday calling for sort of a turnaround in austerity, talking about boosting wages in the U.S. and expanding public services in the EU, things that are sort of counter to the neoliberal consensus. And Greece is looking at this month a review for another advance from the IMF, and there's some dissension going on around that. But Germany and some of the others looking to go one way, just like before, and Lagarde seemingly leaning the other way. What do you think is the solution to the problem that people still aren't really talking about?
Well, the solution is a political agreement that I don't see coming, and that I believe Ms. Lagarde doesn't see coming either, in a peculiar twist that reflects just how bad the situation is. We have the usually conservative, to be polite, IMF taking what is now considered to be a rather progressive position in suggesting that the Greek government of Syriza is quite right, and that without debt relief, all the rest that's being asked of Greece makes no sense in terms of solving Greece's problems, makes only sense in terms of the position of the German government and a few others in Europe, but mostly the German government, that they don't want to make any more concessions to the Greeks. And the reason for that also is political. The German government is not anywhere near as strong as they like to pretend. They have serious troubles inside Germany's economy, and the mass of Germans simply will not support a political leader who keeps dishing out to them economic hardships of various kinds while, quote-unquote, bailing out by forgiving the debts of poorer countries like Greece. They just won't do it. And so she can't. She can't politically survive by giving the Greeks the break, which every economist who isn't a right-wing nut understands is necessary. You know, you squeeze a debtor who can't pay so long as you think that the squeezing can have the effect of getting him to do something that will allow him to pay. When you reach a certain point that the sheer poverty of the debtor makes it impossible for him to do it, then you begin to have a new problem, which is if you keep squeezing, you're going to provoke this debtor into becoming very angry at you and becoming threatening. And then it's stupid to continue, and that's why we have bankruptcy laws. You let people get out of their debts if they can prove they're in that situation. The Greeks are long beyond that. They've proved it, and they've gone beyond it. So holding on is crazy, and it has to be explained as the internal political need of Mrs. Merkel in Germany and people like her in a couple of other countries. And as long as that stalemate exists, as long as places like Germany can't solve their political problems some other way, they're going to be prepared and willing to sacrifice Greeks to keep themselves in power in Germany.
You know, you had a long-term problem, at least in the Western economies for sure, of a slow, gradual impoverishment of the working class and then the middle class, a metabolizing of the assets, particularly of the middle class, beginning in the 70s perhaps, or certainly since the 80s, with the reduction in the share of equity in the homes in favor of banks, and then the collapse of the financial structure that had acquired the beneficial interest of the equity in their homes and piles of debt. Now we're at a point where you obviously need some kind of a reset, you know, like an economic etch-a-sketch being shaken and, erasing it. And you have this political problem where you have those that are in a position to help won't help politically. It's impossible for them to act politically. And then others where it's moving down the line, like in Saudi Arabia, which has been suffering from the drop in oil prices severely, has already taken one step towards austerity with sales taxes and other things, and now is, again, looking at additional austerity, which can't solve the problem. What kind of a solution can be worked out?
Well, I think you have to understand, as always, that this is a systemic problem. This has to do with the whole system. And there's a deep-seated conservatism, even in otherwise left-wing or liberal circles, that drives those folks, honestly in many cases, to hope, to pray, to beg, to shift their brains around in the desperate desire to find some part of the system which, if they could only fix it, would make everything okay again, simply because it's too hard and too scary to get your head around the notion that it's a system as a whole. Let me be very concrete and explain. When the financial sector securitized all the debts that they imposed on their working classes, when they stopped, particularly here in the United States, but you have it elsewhere too, when they stopped giving them wage increases, although they perfectly well could have, and instead said, here, we're not raising your wages anymore, but we're going to drive you through advertising and everything else to want to have a better standard of living, and we'll solve the problem by lending you the money to do that. Okay, so they did that. So the working class acquired debts, or directly or indirectly, the government bought into the debts and then used the money they borrowed to provide working people with the supports they could not afford themselves. Europe did more of the latter. America did more of the former. But here's where it becomes a system problem. Those debts are negotiable. In other words, they're like IOUs. The IOU of the family that borrows to buy its house. The IOU of the family that borrows to buy its car, to handle its credit card debt, and now to send its kid to college. These debts become investments for other people, pension funds, corporations, wealthy people, all kinds of entities, hedge funds. And they then begin to do all kinds of economic activities, thinking that the wealth they have invested in these debts of other people are reliable and solid. You can't then write off the debt of Greece without understanding that it is going to be a major blow to everybody who owns the debt of the Greek government, and they in turn will now be affected and make all kinds of new decisions because that wealth has disappeared because the Greek government is let off. It's, in other words, it's spread all through the system. Those of you who may not know it is when the Greek government cut back on its debts a couple of years ago, it completely destroyed the banking system both in Greece and in Cyprus because they were owners of these governmental IOUs. And they, in turn, then had to impoverish all kinds of people dependent on them, worsening the situation in Greece far beyond what it had been before that. In other words, you can't fix it by even letting the Greek government do it, because that will produce a cascading other set of problems, not to speak of the anxiety for all the people who hold similar debt in governments like Portugal or Italy, who are going to scratch their heads and start running for the exits, dumping those government securities, which in turn will drop their price and lead to other. You see what I'm saying? It's a systemic problem. And to rephrase your question, what we are coming to is a growing awareness that the problem really is systemic. And for those who run this system, as they become clear of it, they become more desperate and will be more and more likely to revert to extra legal and dangerous ways to keep an exploding system going. And on the other hand, you're going to see more and more people beginning to think about system change. And Trump and Bernie Sanders are perfect examples of where that's going. And you see it also this last week in France, where you have the bizarre spectacle of a socialist government deploying troops in a dozen French cities against students and other young working people who don't want to lose their labor rights and confront a law pushed over them by the very socialists they voted into office 3 years ago. These are signs of a systemic breakdown.
You know, I remember in the early 1990s and with Jeffrey Sachs and others going over to help Russia fumble through the aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union. You had millions and millions of people who had acquired pensions and built some substantial savings under the Soviet economy that saw, that they were told basically, that these things had to be wiped out because A, they were built on a foundation of air, and B, in order to rationalize the economy, this was necessary. This looks exactly like that, only I would venture to say that this particular financialized wealth rests on an even shakier foundation. Why can't they bring themselves to see the need for this kind of a structural, you know, reset?
Well, I mean, it's a perfectly good question, Don, but my answer is to remind everyone of what is almost always, and perhaps it's really always true, that historically, when you look back on the collapse of the Greek empires, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, one of the things historians find themselves doing is shaking their heads and saying more or less the following. How come these people couldn't see the writing on the wall? How come they couldn't take account of something that's so obvious to us looking back on the situation? Why didn't they at least try to deal with why did they march with the silly grin on their face right over the abyss leading to the collapse of their empires? I think we're seeing the same thing now. To use the example of Greece from the earlier part of our conversation, it is crystal clear that Greece is in a situation where if you don't give them a lot of help, including writing down their debt in some way that you can try at least to manage the consequences, you're just going to have a lingering disaster, and it will have all kinds of scary consequences. So you might as well make at least a reasonable effort now rather than simply watch it all crumble. Well, as I told you, most people see it, but they're stuck in a stasis because of the political barriers that the same system has erected that preclude them from acting. They can't at this point. And even when they get together in a restaurant and they tell each other, which I've seen, that this is absurd what's being done to Greece, none of the people in a position to do something about it dares, because of the systemic problems, to be the one who says, okay, I'm going to do something. And so we watch the situation. By the way, we've been doing this now in Greece for a good 3+ years. So it is lasting and lasting and lasting. And the situation gets worse and worse and worse. And I think the street demonstrations in France, the fact that 1.5 million young people have now signed an online petition demanding that the government retract the law, I mean, you're seeing extraordinary action here of the sort that presages this kind of disintegration, which in retrospect, nobody can believe.
And we're seeing that kind of political fallout here, of course, with the Republican Party, for example, which had a strong segment of its coalition based on religious ideology. Many of those people are now looking at the Republican candidacy of Trump and saying, he can get me a job. I really don't care about abortion, etc. Even people that have been voting that way for the last 30 years. And in the Democratic Party, you have people lining up behind a guy who calls himself a socialist.
Yep. I think you're seeing people who have, in the European way of speaking, lost confidence in the traditional power structures. Let me remind everyone of the advanced examples, which will help show where the Trump-Sanders dichotomy is going. Up until 2012 in Greece, you had two parties, very like the Republicans and Democrats. One was called New Democracy. The other one was called the Greek Socialist Party. They together got two-thirds or more of the vote. They were in complete control of the government. They handed off to one another the prime ministership. One had it for a few years and the other one had it. It was all very polite. It was all very well understood. You had dynastic families in one party and dynastic families in the other. It was all predictable. Then it hit the fan in Greece, worse, sooner than it has elsewhere. And guess what happened? Those two parties went from regularly getting two-thirds of the vote to today, the two together can't get one-third of the vote. The Socialist Party of Greece virtually disappeared. It's now getting 3 or 4%, and the other one is in the 20s. So this is a disaster. Second example, Portugal. The government of Portugal was like that, and today the government of Portugal is a coalition of three parties: the Portuguese Socialist Party, the Portuguese Communist Party, and the Portuguese Green Party. Uh-oh, that means the old tradition of Portuguese government, like the old tradition of Greek government, is gone, rejected by people who have no confidence in traditional political expression. Trump and Sanders represent an earlier, less developed, less self-conscious step in the exact same direction, so that I would expect you're going to see more and starker divisions even after the individuals of Trump and Sanders are no longer the players on the on this particular theater.
You know, and in the United States, in the economy here, you have an analogy to the EU's treatment of Greece. If you look, for example, at mortgages since 2008, I know, you know, just from my own anecdotal experience with people that I know that are in their 40s, 30s, even early 50s, their mortgages haven't been paid since maybe 2009 in many cases, many of them not foreclosed. You had various programs, including HAMP, where they were supposed to, and federal court decisions mandating that the banks find any available alternative to foreclosure before they foreclose. And in many cases, a forgiveness of part of the debt is an essential element of people being able to continue to make the payments and to keep the houses. And yet, banks generally are refusing to do that. So with that as like an economic model of what happened in negotiations between Greece and the creditors, the political divisions that you're seeing forming with groups of insurgents basically against the political establishment, how can anyone from the political sphere impose that kind of discipline here?
Well, it's always a case of being, if you're a politician, of being able to get your constituents to do what you want to do. And a classic standard way of doing that is to convince them that if they don't, something much more awful is going to befall them. And then grumbling, bitter, suspicious, dubious, they go along because they're afraid. And I think what you're going to see in this country is the beginning of a massive upramping of what we used to call the lesser evil type of argument. This is awful, but it's less awful than what will happen if we don't do it. So you must do it. You must do it. You must do it. And my suspicion is that's the only way you'll overcome this. If I could comment on your question itself. The mortgage thing is a perfect example. Those mortgages bundled up into securities that you're talking about were then sold to all kinds of people who in turn made all kinds of economic bets and assumptions and investments based on the values of those mortgage securities. They can't, and I don't mean to defend them, but they can't simply write them down. It's not like a bank owned them. The bank only made the deal and then immediately sold off these mortgages into those bundles. So you're now having the ultimate owners who borrowed money, for example, on the value of those securities. They can't let them go down. Otherwise, the people they borrowed from will demand repayment, which they can't manage. So you're telling them you're going to have to destroy yourself in order to help the debtor who can't pay a mortgage. They're not going to do it. The other thing is that there is a parallel of Greece for Europe, and that's Puerto Rico. And it's something that's getting very little attention in the United States because of the desire to pretend that we aren't doing something very similar. Puerto Rico is the poorest part of the United States economy, pretty much like Greece is one of the poorest parts of the European economy. We are currently savaging the island of Puerto Rico. It has a current sales tax of 11.5%. No other state in the United States comes close to that. A sales tax is most burdensome on the people with no money. It makes no effort to distinguish your capacity to pay. It doesn't charge people more who have more money. It hits the lowest income people with the highest percentage of their money to be spent on this tax. It's outrageous. You've cut the budgets of the University of Puerto Rico. You've cut every other budget. You're now in court trying to get a new law out of Congress so you can go into bankruptcy. You're dealing with your creditors who are demanding that you pay them off before you even provide basic services. This is very Greek-like, and we're doing it to the Puerto Rican island. It only has 3 million people. It's driving many of them to go to the mainland where they can join an army of people getting low-skilled, low-paid jobs in an economy that can't even provide that to its own people. I mean, this is a disaster compounded, much like the Greek one is, and for very similar reasons.
And finally, if the political structures aren't able to resolve the problem, and the economy continues to operate in the fashion that it's operating, on the track that it's operating, where does it go?
Well, the only answer you can get in these situations is by borrowing from history, knowing, of course, that circumstances now are not what they were back then. But then again, where else are you going to look? In the 1930s, a little-known chapter of the Great Depression happened in many rural areas, particularly in the Midwest and the southern parts of the Midwest, and it went something like this. Bankers and lenders had provided loans to farmers. The farmers couldn't sell their produce because people in the cities had no money, being unemployed. The farmers, therefore, could not get the money they needed to pay back their loans. The banks and the other creditors said, okay, we're taking your land. The answer of the farmers was, if you take our land, then we have nothing and we'll be even less able to pay the loans we owe you. The banks didn't care. They took the land. The farmers were then confronted with abject disaster because the land was the only way they lived. They couldn't go into the cities. There was 25% unemployment there already, and they had a disadvantage from being rural. So guess what they did? They began to form militias. And they began to arrive at the court on the day that a particular farmer was to have his or her land taken from them. And they stood around with guns and they said to the judge, you better find in favor of the farmer and against the banker, because if you don't, you're not leaving here, or you're not leaving here alive. This happened, and it happened repeatedly. It required Roosevelt, the president, to call out the National Guard, which didn't always win in standoffs with local farmers for whom this was literally a life and death situation. Will it come to that in this country? I don't know. But a lot more people have a lot more guns in this country today than they did back then. And you are putting people in impossible situations in an increasing number with no outlet at a time when there are no jobs, when public services are being cut back. This is not a question of whether this is going to blow up. It's just a question of exactly where, exactly when, and in exactly what form. And I don't know how far down that road we all have to go before there's a decision to begin to make the kinds of changes that didn't seem possible 6 months earlier, but suddenly come on to the horizon. And I think that's probably what we're waiting to see.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.